Welcome to the Anxiety Lab. Welcome back to the Anxiety Lab. I'm Sagar Bhatt. Hope you're doing well. And if you're not totally well, I am sending you some compassion right now. Today's guest is meditation teacher and author Mark Van Buren, who I love talking to. Mark leads meditation workshops, silent retreats, corporate wellness classes. He offers simple tools and practices that can reduce stress, help with anxiety and depression, manage pain, and transform the many difficult aspects of life. Mark is the author of two books. The first one is A Fool's Guide to Actual Happiness, and the second is Your Life is Meditation. Both of these are available through his website, which I will link in the description, along with his Instagram. So Mark, I didn't know Mark previously. I heard him on another podcast. I just felt conflicted right then, revealing to you that there are, in fact, other podcasts. I guess you could listen. But I heard Mark. I reached out to him. I cold called him. And, you know, I'm out there. I'm cold calling people sometimes. I'm emailing. I'm trying to get some good guests for you all. I'm you know, DMing people I see who I want to talk to, faxing telegrams. I'm knocking on doors. Hot air balloons with binoculars. I'm out there looking for guests. And Mark was super nice. He didn't know me, but I got a really friendly response from him. And we kind of hit it off right away with a couple phone calls before the episode. And Mark, what I love about Mark, he's such a passionate teacher. You could hear it in his voice. Such a warm spirit, someone who, you know, has taken a deep dive into the mind and now wants to help people feel better. So I'm excited to present this episode to you. Before we get to that, I got some stuff. I got some admin stuff on my end. I mentioned on the last episode that there might be a delay due to some travel before this episode, and there was. And now, unfortunately, I must inform you that now, after that unexpected hiatus, we are now going to be into a planned hiatus. After this episode. The reason being, one is just bandwidth. I'm working on a couple other things. One of those is landedapp.net. That is my free social gratitude app. I'm really enjoying how that's been developing. And so I want to, it needs more of my time now. And once again, I'm beta testing on that for iPhone users. If you're interested, just go to landedapp.net and sign up. Once again, it is 100% free. It's a good app. It's a good kind of mindful alternative to our traditional options for social media. Working on some other things. One of those is actually a live show. Before this was a podcast, pre-pandemic, I had planned on doing a live show that was kind of anxiety and mindfulness themed along with some comedy. So I'm going to be doing that somewhere in New York City. If you want info on that, you can email theanxietylab@gmail.com. And I'll let you know when and if that's happening. And if you are connected to a cool venue in this city where it might make sense, please reach out to me as well. The second reason for the hiatus is I think, you know, with this last run of episodes going back to Aparna, I've gotten out most of what I want to say, at least for now. And I think it's now time once again to maybe go a little bit more inward, deepen my own practice. I'm doing a retreat, hopefully in a few months, and I'm looking forward to that. Before I give you, you know, more conversations. As I said before, I don't want my kind of content output to outpace my own practice and investigation. And I'm not here just to throw content at you because that's what podcasters do. I want to do this when I have something to say. But there will be more. Don't get me wrong. I 100% have interviews on the calendar and I'll be putting them out as they are ready. And I think that's how I'll do it, at least for the near term, is there's a couple conversations I want to have, or when I feel compelled to talk to someone or have an idea I want to unpack, I'll do it, I'll record it, and then I'll put it out. And when I don't, I will stand down. So it'll be, you know, a few one-offs over the next few months. Definitely stay subscribed, keep this channel open. I don't know what this means officially for those diehard Anxiety Labradoodles, whether this is any kind of end of season two or whether I'm just merely stretching out season two. It is my fantasy that there are forums, fan forums of diehard anxiety labradoodles just debating whether a certain episode was season two or season three. I don't know. I thought he ended it. No, he never said it was official. So this is technically season two. And those debates could go on forever. And that is my dream. Feel free to do that. No one will do it. It'll never happen. This is the last breath of that very thought. Anyway, this schedule change will no doubt hurt my subscription numbers, but it's what I got to do. And what you got to do is write me a review. I'm going to pause right now, or you can pause, and give me a rating. Doesn't take too long. I'll tell you a story. This is, I'm a little bit conflicted sharing this, but I had an uncle. He didn't really know about podcasts or, you know, the podcast app on his iPhone. And then when I showed him, I used his phone to show him my podcast. But as I queued up my podcast, I quickly threw myself a 5-star rating on his phone. And so that one data point is manipulated. I think as of last count, I have 54 reviews via Apple. And one of those is corrupt. I think if you're really taking me to task, it would be 53 positive reviews. If you're someone who only listens to podcasts that have 54 or more positive reviews, I'm afraid I've lost you at this point, but hopefully come back in a month where a couple of my other listeners will have done something good and given me that rating / review. And lastly, do I have a lastly? Yeah. If you haven't heard any of the other episodes, I encourage you to go back. I put a lot of work into them, and the themes are pretty timeless, and I try to put as much in the description as possible. So definitely check those out. And if you liked something or remember liking an episode, re-listening isn't a bad idea. When it comes to these topics, I'm personally, you know, always need at least a couple listens to listen to, you know, my favorite mindfulness talk, or I'm rereading books that were impactful for me. And I always, it's never a bad idea. I get as much or even more sometimes on the second or third readings / listenings. Okay, that's all I got. And here is my conversation with Mark Van Buren, which ends with a guided meditation practice from Mark. So stick around for that. Okay, enjoy. Sorry, one quick note. I realize we start this episode with a quote, and I think the attribution got cut off. So the quote I start with is by Buddhist teacher Waylon Lewis. Okay, here we go. Your life doesn't change because you read Eckhart Tolle or Pema Chodron or practice meditation or travel the world or whatever. Your life will change when you integrate what you've learned into daily in-the-moment practice. So I think that just hit me pretty hard. It was just such a reminder for how important this day-to-day integration is for me. I mean, oftentimes, I mean, even on this podcast, I'll talk to someone and we'll land on something that feels like growth, and or I'm reading a Dharma book. I like, you know, currently I'm reading some Joseph Goldstein, and I will in the moment feel, okay, now I got it. This part I've figured out. I figured out this aspect of anxiety and suffering, and there's this sense of I'm good now. Even though I'm reading them specifically telling me that it's a practice and it takes work, right. You know, in that moment, the feeling is as though I've fused this intel into my own brain.
Oh no, this is such a key point. I mean, and you know, I'm also a yoga instructor, and I, just to get to this point, I often say in my classes, like, I don't care if you could do a handstand, right? I don't care if you could do a split. What I care about is how you live off your mat, right? And that's exactly what you're kind of talking about, what this quote is about. Like, we're not trying to get good at sitting and breathing, right? And I'm not downplaying the formal practice by any means. You really should have a consistent daily practice, and retreats are important. But where it's expressed is in your daily life. I remember going to church when I was younger, and everyone would be really nice for an hour and dress up really nice. And the rest of the week, you know, they were assholes, you know, or they just were like not, you know, living in line with what they were for that tiny hour. And as I mentioned to you on the phone just the other day, my one favorite college professor used to say, well, what does this have to do with Tuesday afternoon? And Buddhism can fall into these traps too. You talk about emptiness and, you know, all different concepts, and it becomes very intellectual and heady. And,
yeah.
And then it's like, but you're still acting so unskillfully in your daily life. Like, so there, you have to bridge those two together. And that's where my second book comes along. Like, your life is meditation. It's not like, again, you need the formal practice, but at the same time, it's not like all about sitting. It's how are you relating to this moment? And that's all we have. And 90% of our lives, if not 99% of our lives, is normal daily life stuff, you know? And I used to get so upset because I'd go on retreats and I'd get all blissed out and I'd get, you know, feel like I was really deep and everything was good. And then I'd come back to my life and I'd fall right back into the same patterns. And then I thought, well, I just need more retreat time, but that's not realistic because I need to live a life and I need to, you know, be in the world. So eventually I had that realization probably a lot later than necessary, but it was like, maybe this is it. And maybe I just need to relate to this. And,
yeah.
You know, there is no grand finale. There is no, as Jack Kornfield would say, enlightened retirement, right? One of my favorite books by him, After the Ecstasy, The Laundry. Right. And it talks about that.
I think I love that title more than I love the book.
Yeah.
Which isn't to, I'm not trying to trash the book. It's a great book. I'm looking at it right now on my bookshelf. Yeah, but I bought it because of that title. I think that title speaks volumes.
Right.
And you know, I've actually heard a monk say that if you go into concepts and teachings too early, then they take on the form of expectations. You know, it remains a concept,
right,
rather than breathing in mindfulness in everyday waking reality. I mean, I had this moment, I think just yesterday, I sat for 30 minutes in the morning and I just couldn't settle, lots of thoughts. And then in the afternoon, I wasn't planning this. I was just in the bathroom and I was replacing a roll of toilet paper and I was looking at the new roll of toilet paper. And I just was, for some reason, laser focused in that moment and just feeling the textures. I wish that I had something a little bit more palatable to use as an example for this rant, I guess, but it was literally toilet paper.
That's awesome.
I mean, if I was a polished teacher, we'd be talking about the taste of a blueberry or something, but no, I was just holding toilet paper. Something about maybe the light in the bathroom, I just felt complete stillness. And just the physicality of holding this and the feeling in my hand. I guess it could have been anything.
Right.
But, and I felt more, I guess, present in that moment than I did in my entire 30-minute sit. And then I thought to this quote that you shared, and I was like, yeah. I mean, and granted, you could say that the reason why I was able to access that later in the day is because I primed the pump earlier with meditation. And sometimes you don't, you know, it's just laying the groundwork for those moments to emerge more often.
Right.
And it's hard to predict when they happen, but in general, it does correlate. The more you sit and the more you practice presence, the more it'll emerge in those moments. And you're right. Ultimately, that is what we're going for. Those, however long you sit is just to better orient you to reality as you go about your day. That's not a side benefit. That is the benefit.
Right. And we want to be careful too, because we kind of get into this idea that, you know, like the distractedness is bad and that, you know, that makes us bad at meditation. So many people give up because they really just expect, okay, I'm just going to sit down and I'm going to just be able to let go of everything and be with the breath. And if you've practiced even one time, you know that that's not the case. So, you know, I try to have a very expansive approach to this, and I'd be careful to teach about, let's say, specific goals or benefits. There are, and they do come, but I try to not talk about that as much because, you know, sometimes it's just a busy mind and mm-hmm. you can sit with that. And literally it's just a busy, distracted mind. Like, it just that simple acknowledgement is already freeing. It's like, ah, busy mind today, right? It's the problem.
It all just becomes another thing to observe.
Right. And even the stillness. And as I'm sure you know, the toilet paper and that Zen moment, it goes away, right? And then you're back to distractedness again. So it's like, how do I hold both? How do I find a way to have that equanimity and ease and learn to welcome the distracted mind along with the enlightenment moment, you know?
And it happens with meditation teachings, like, oh, I get it now. And then 5 hours later, you don't get it. Or 5 minutes later, you don't get it. But it's also true with anything in the vicinity of willpower, of like, I swear I'm not going to have, I'm done eating chips. I'm not going to go. And then, you know, 30 seconds later, I'm back in the pantry or I'm back on Instagram, even though I've told myself. And that's, it's such a subtle yet telling, I guess, reveal of this quality of the mind, which is, I guess, impermanence and non-self. Like in the moment, I feel as though I am this all-knowing, cohesive CEO that's in charge of myself, and there's continuity from this moment to the next moment. So if I say right now, I'm not going to check Instagram for the rest of the day, it feels solid and secure. And then a couple hours later, where is that guy who said that?
Yeah.
You know, it's this new person who wants to justify checking.
Right.
And so that right there is, I mean, it's a subtle, but it's a window into a very powerful teaching in Buddhism, in my opinion.
Right. And I think that's a great thing to notice, the fluidity of self and you know, and to notice that you have a self that wants to check, you have a self that doesn't want to check, you have a self that thinks he's awake, you have a self that thinks he's a piece of crap, you have a, you know, and it's just like all these identifications, which on one level are you, but on another level aren't you at all. You know, it's just, and it's finding that balance and learning to just flow with the moment. And that's why I really like to teach, not just like, how do I feel good? How do I, you know, get rid of this? Or how do I hold on to this? I mean, it doesn't go with the teachings at all. It's how do I hold even this, right? You know, and, you know, the teaching of just, this is it, is such a crucial thing. Like, so this moment, whatever's arising, this is life. There's nothing else. There's no other time. There's no other place. So it's, how am I relating to this? And can I relate to this from a clarity? It doesn't have to be a stillness, because the mind doesn't cooperate like that. But there can be a clarity that shines through underneath the noise, you know, very similar to, you know, the sky and the clouds. You know, there's the clouds, but there's always that spaciousness underneath that's always present.
You know, and also this general, I mean, this is pretty broad in terms of the theory, but just, you know, watching all of these things happen while we are resting in a larger awareness, it's important to really build that larger awareness and feeling of groundedness over time, or else it'll just be another thing that we're chasing or conceptualizing.
Right.
Like, we're told all the time, thoughts aren't, you know, to drop the stories, to do this, to turn away from the thoughts, and that they don't necessarily correspond to the truth,
right?
All of these stories and everything, we're told that all the time. So I think it's important to, you know, to maybe trust that wisdom and to tap maybe more and more into the body, into the present. And then over time, we can begin to see why they're not as true and significant. You know, at first, we maybe just have to trust the wisdom and trust the teachers, and maybe take that step of just sustained practice. But then over time, you know, hopefully there can emerge a sense of like, yeah, this thought is a little bit more porous and transient and weird and abstract than what it felt like before. This thought of like, oh, I gotta be whatever, famous, or I gotta, you know, my fucking friend should have texted me back sooner. And all of that stuff just has maybe a lightness to it. That's revealed over time, you know, as we build up more and more of a relationship with present reality, this physical space that we're in right now. Like, if you're listening, just take a second and tap into just the physical space that you're occupying, your body, your immediate surroundings, and notice how that's a very different experience than the stuff that's going on in your mind. And in the context of this physical groundedness, the mind activity just, it loosens up a little bit. You know, that to me is maybe the most efficient way I can communicate some of this. Right? You pick up what I'm putting down, or is that?
This is all great. This is all, we could talk for hours about all this stuff. Yeah, it's just like Jack Kornfield says it all the time, that we're this loving awareness, this spacious loving awareness. But really kind of what happens is this spaciousness collapses into, thoughts and feelings and moods and, you know, what I like and what I don't like. I've been calling it me world or small mindedness. And, you know, this is kind of where we get stuck. Like everything's naturally this, think of it like everything's naturally this open question, right? But we want these small definitions and answers, you know? So we kind of create this small little cocoon that we call self. It makes us feel secure. It makes us feel in control. And it makes us feel like we really exist in the way that we think we do. And, you know, when we sit in meditation, you know, especially if you're doing mindfulness meditation or insight meditation, you're literally just resting in that spacious mind, you know, and it's not like we have to attain it. Our true nature is open. Our true nature is spacious. You know, that's the true nature of mind. But what we do have to attain is repeatedly letting go of small-mindedness, right? Because we're so addicted to ourself that there is a practice, there is a path, you know, because on one level, there is no path, you're already it, and that's it. But on another level, you know, you're not, because you're so caught on yourself that you have to practice letting go of yourself repeatedly over and over again.
Yeah, that's where sometimes I get annoyed. Where I mean, I think it's, I'm not saying it's wrong,
right,
but
right.
When you know this message of oh, it's already there, it's right in front of you. But then it's like, all right, well, I guess I'm that much more stupid now for not seeing it. And I guess for me, it's if I still don't see it, then what use is this message that it's already there to me? You know, I guess maybe that's something that gets revealed over time. It's something that maybe is true retroactively that you can understand, oh, it was in front of me this whole time, this maybe right. Awakened heart or this maybe feeling of awareness over what's going on.
I think you learn to trust it. I think there's a trusting spirit that, and I don't mean like a spirit, like some like ghost thing, just like, you know, the trusting spirit, that comes with practice, and that you learn that your heart mind, right, that your heart and mind are spacious enough to hold whatever life offers, right? And
yeah.
The daily sitting is what really teaches you that over time, because you're sitting, especially, you know, that's why the discipline of daily practice is so important, because some days you sit and you're distracted, just like you said this morning or the other day. Some days you sit and you're at peace. Some days you sit and you're sick. Some days you sit and you're healthy. So, you know, you sit when you're young, then you sit and you're old. But there is something that's been there that's, you know, and again, I want to be careful not to make it into some permanent thing. But at the same time, there is this open, spacious quality that's always available to us. So even when we feel like we're suffocating and things are shrinking or, you know, bad stuff's happening, that there is this level of reality that can just receive it. You know, like as soon as you open your eyes, there's something that is just aware of sights. Before the mind comes in and says, that's a pillow. Ooh, I love pillows. They're soft and I like sleeping on them. And ooh, that there's that nick in the wall that, you know, I got to spackle and oh God, I hate spackling. You know, it's just like as soon as you open your eyes, there's already this level of receiving and openness and, you know, not expecting anything. And so we learn to sit in that. And I practice mainly in the Chan and Zen tradition, which, you know, we sit Zazen, right? Or something called silent illumination, just sitting, right? Brad Warner, he says, sit down and shut up. That was the name of one of his books. And it's just, you sit there and you just literally rest in spacious awareness. The problem, and I think for beginners, is you can't just go sit in spacious awareness, you know? And that's where I think you need a method to start. You need to count the breath. You need a mantra, because you don't even realize or know or have that wisdom to see when your mind pulls you away, right?
Absolutely.
You'll be sitting there and you'll just be away. You won't even be in the moment. You won't be fully present. So I think the first year, if not more, of practice, you really need to focus on being able to concentrate and not concentrate in a way. I don't believe in the single pointedness where you shut the world out, but you know, just like a very gentle anchor, that will start to teach you to wake up to when your mind pulls you away, and then you come back, and then you're breathing, and it's like, oh, you know, I'm really hungry right now and pretty bored. Ah, thinking. And then you're back to that anchor. And over time you learn to stay present. It doesn't mean your mind gets quiet. It does get quieter sometimes. I mean, I would say my mind's much quieter than 13 years ago, but not always. But the difference is, thoughts used to be right here in my face. Yeah. And they used to pull me and throw me and beat me. And now thoughts are like bubbles that arise that I can, you know, Pema Chodron says, you know, to just acknowledge it. It's like touching a bubble with a feather. It's just like, yes, I'm bored. Okay. Pop. Yep. Okay. Yes. Like, oh, I have to do this for work later. Yeah, you're right. I do. Thanks. You know, and it's just so much nicer to sit with myself now, you know, because I just see them as thoughts and nothing personal, and I don't need to war with them, and I don't need to get rid of them, that I can just sit there and be with what is. And that's what we need to understand. And as Westerners, as consumers, it's like, I need to get something. You know, if I'm going to invest my time and my money into this practice, I need to get something out of it. And it's the wrong approach, because it's the me that wants, that's the very thing that's causing us the problem. Something's wrong. Something's missing. It should be like this. It shouldn't be like this, you know, and to be able to let that go and just say, okay, now this, right? That's my practice. Now this, right? And it's not a dismissive, like I'm not running away and saying, now this, poor me. It's okay. Now this, let me fully engage with this from a place of wisdom, with a little bit more compassion and kindness. And try from that absolute state, right? If we, you know, when we start talking about absolute relative, it can get in too heady. But at the same time, you know, to live from that spacious quality in this finite world, that's a mess, you know?
Yeah, sometimes I am like, okay, let's watch the thoughts. The thoughts are just bubbles. But then what if one of those bubbles is, holy shit, I forgot to pay rent? And right. And so sometimes it's easy to get cynical with this stuff, like, oh, really? Thoughts are just thoughts? Well, okay, what happens when I get evicted? But the more I understand, that's not what the wisdom is saying. It's not saying to just disqualify every thought as it comes up. And so I think it's important to point out it is absolutely true that some thoughts have more resonance or more truth than others, or some thoughts warrant action more than others. But that's... doesn't mean that there's not something worthwhile in terms of, you know, just treating thoughts on occasion, one of those occasions being during a meditation practice, as thoughts being simply a bubble or a cloud as they float by as you rest more and more in the spacious awareness. And so you begin to see the nature of this very mechanism of thought. And so there's great value in that, right?
Yeah, and the thoughts aren't a problem. I mean, and meditation tends to fall into that, like, demonizing thoughts. Like, you need thoughts. And I think Jack Kornfield said something along the lines, like, you need to remember your true nature, but your social security number, you know, like,
yeah, I love that.
And it needs to be practical. We're not trying to get rid of thoughts and be a rock. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're just trying to learn which thoughts are skillful and wholesome and lead to freedom and ease and joy and compassion, and which thoughts keep us in our cocoon and keep us suffering. You know, and the unskillful ones are the ones we learn to kind of just see and let them fall away. And paying the rent, like, oh shit, I forgot to pay the rent. Okay, let me go pay it. You know, like
even in these true thoughts, quote unquote true thoughts, there's still stuff to notice. You know, like noticing, we're talking about simply the naked observation of the very process of thoughts. It's not that I'm saying, okay, this thought is good, this one is bad. Rather, let's just see all of these thoughts in their textures and imagery and their transience, if we're really kind of anchored in presence. So like, yeah, even if this is a true thought about paying rent, like, yes, it's true, it's due, I need to pay it. There might still be, even with that, some like doomsday scenes that I'm playing out in my head about like making my landlord mad or being evicted or just overall images of me as a failure and feelings around that. So what we're doing is we're observing all of that. So then even a quote unquote true thought is, it turns out it's not as real as the way it's being presented.
And I think, you know, to realize that this practice is showing us that we have the freedom to choose how to respond to thoughts, to our emotions, to other people, to situations, to whatever is presenting itself. It is a reminder that there's enough space if, and, you know, and as you practice, you learn to rest in that free kind of space more and more throughout your day, but that you have that possibility of freedom, of choosing how to respond. So yes, I need to pay the rent. That's skillful. But then all the other stuff, like, oh, what if this, what if that? Like, okay, that's just worry. Let me, you know, call my, you know, you could just, how am I going to respond? Not just react habitually.
Yeah.
It's okay. Yeah. Okay. I'm feeling anxious right now. And my mind's telling me to stay home, but I'm going to go to work. Let's go, anxiety. And, you know, as you get to know your anxiety better, as you learn to let go of thoughts that are unskillful, and as that practice becomes, you know, better, no, I don't want to say better, but as it becomes, I don't know, more of second nature, you know, that you have this skill and you're getting, I'm going to just use the word better for now, better at it, at letting go of thoughts, at being with things that are uncomfortable, then you can navigate through life in a much easier way, you know, or not even easier, a wiser and skillful way. I don't want to say easier because, you know, who knows what life can give some people, but that there can be a wiser way of relating. So like, and that freedom's there. So yes, you have anxiety. It doesn't have to cripple you and make you lay in bed, right? It can, and sometimes it will, but that possibility is there to say, wow, this is really uncomfortable and I want to sit in bed. My mind is telling me to sit in bed, but I'm going to get up. Right. And it's just like, and when you see that you have that choice, that anxiety does not have control over your body. You know, all the only thing anxiety can do is feel shitty for a certain period of time. Mm. And it has to change. It doesn't mean it's going to go away forever, but it has to change. It has to lessen at some point. Nobody's at 110% anxiety 24/7. I mean, I think you just die, you know, but you can see like sometimes it's, you can't breathe, and then it's, you know, just a little knot in your chest or your stomach. And then your heart's racing, and, you know, and you learn to be with these things. And you rest in that absolute, if we want to call it that, that's inner spaciousness that's already there, that potential for freedom. And then you can say, okay, anxiety, how you doing? You know, welcome. You can be here too. We're going to work together today. Come on, let's go. You know, you feel really, you feel really shitty today. Thanks. Thanks for expressing yourself. Let's go. And that's such an important thing too, is this unconditional friendliness. That's a big part of meditation, is, you know, we sit with ourselves, and whether we're distracted, anxious, angry, in pain, you know, healthy, sick, whatever, that we hold ourselves as we are. And we say, okay, now, you know, this is current state of body and mind. And okay, you can be that way. And that little bit of friendliness goes a long way. And not even just towards yourself, just in life in general, like just being a little kind to people. You'd be surprised how rare that is. You know, we're from the tri-state area, so people being kind and patient and respectful and actually seeing somebody, you know, that is right there, whether it's like the person at McDonald's taking your order, you know, a person at work that, you know, is quiet, you know, but just seeing people and being there and giving them attention and being kind, like all these things seems so like stupid and like, duh, everybody should do it. But at least around us, you know, and the places I go to, it's very rare. I can't tell you how many people I look in the eye and they look me in the eye, say, good morning. And they walk right by me. Like how much suffering does somebody have to have in their life to not be able to acknowledge another human being? It was just saying good morning. You know, or what kind of habitual self-centered, you know, tendencies are they strengthening every day? That, like, how do you get to that point? And how have we gotten to that point as human beings? Like,
right,
that we just don't interact anymore and we don't care and we don't, you know, like I have a few people in my life that will go out of their way for me. And I really appreciate that, that will be kind to me every day when I go to work, that won't just like take out their shit on me, you know, like, this practice really gets you in touch with something that's so stupidly obvious, and like that it's like you should be already living this way if you're not. But it goes such a long way and it makes such a big difference. And you know what you bring to, let's say, your job, like that spreads to the people. Like, think about if like an angry person walked into this, well, not walked in, but like, you know, cyberly came onto this, we'd both feel it, right? And then imagine if the Dalai Lama had popped on, like we'd feel that too. So it's like what you do inside and how you relate to yourself and how you relate to difficulty and, you know, pain and your suffering, it has an effect everywhere you go, you know, and we have to remember that, like, and make it our priority to take care of ourselves, because that's how we're going to be in the world.
Totally. I agree with all of that. I wanted to ask you too. So if we're talking about this maybe awakened spaciousness within us, that's, you know, as you mentioned, it's maybe not particularly useful to think of it as something that's always there, something that we can always, I mean, it is true that it's always there. And I do believe that we can always tap into it, but it might not, that might not be helpful for someone to hear. It might just be frustrating to hear and preachy. So, for me too, because I'm not necessarily someone who's mastered, you know, feeling this way. By the way, I wasn't suggesting anyone's being preachy about this. I was just commenting on how.
Hallelujah.
You do have a Catholic background. Am I right?
Yeah.
But no, I was just commenting on how it can land on the person who's like, well, what the fuck? I don't fucking see it. It's right in front of me. Fuck you. You know?
Yeah. Well, that's why, I don't like to talk about it as a concept, but I like to teach people that, you know, we could just pause right now and observe our mind, right? And that you right now, whoever you are out there, you can sit there, you can close your eyes, and you can see the thoughts that arise in your mind, right? So you're already aware. Like, you already have it. Like, it's not some abstract, like mystical, you know, foreign thing. It's just something so natural and obvious that we just need to go back to. You know, when I teach classes, I ask people, you know, what makes up this room? And people will be like, they'll look around. They're trying to figure out like the answer I'm looking for, but they'll be like, the floor, you know, they'll be like the paint, the couch. You know, they'll just keep going on, and nobody usually ever gets the answer I'm looking for, which is the space, right? Without the space, there is no room, right? And it's something so obvious, and it's right there, right in front of us. But we look right past it at all the decorations. We're distracted by the decorations. So it's the same thing. Like, in our mind, there's this open, awake clarity that's already there. But we get distracted by the thought paintings and the, you know, the furniture emotions, or, you know, I'm just trying to, you know, get that analogy together, but we don't see what's right there. So if we make it this abstract, the absolute, it can be like, fuck this guy. But if we just say, like, just pause and realize that you can pay attention, that there is an observer, there is a knowing quality that you can just see for yourself by, like, can you hear sounds? Great. Who's hearing that? That's right. It. That's what, you know, that's exactly what we're talking about. Who's hearing it? Who's aware of the thoughts in the mind? Who is it that's angry? Who is it that's anxious? And you can even ask those questions when you're feeling anxious, like, well, who's anxious? And you might just say, screw you, Mark, it's me who's anxious. But what are you referring to? Your bones? Are your bones anxious? Are your fingernails anxious? Are your eyeballs anxious? Is your hair anxious? You know, and it's worth investigating, because we solidify so quickly, and we have this idea that it's, I'm suffering. What is he talking about? It's me. But what are you referring to? You know, like, who is, you know, who's owning that experience? And what is that really how things are, right? That's what Dharma means with the, you know, the big D is like the teachings of how things are, like, how are things really, you know? And yes, there is this sense of meanness, but where is that? And again, I mean, like, I've been exploring lately the 32 parts of the body meditation. I don't know if you ever heard of this, but basically, like, it's a whole list of body parts, and you repeat them. You do five times. And this isn't exact, the exact Tibetan, but I do it five times to just get some concentration and to quiet myself. And then I slowly go through the list, and like, it's like head hair. So I try to get a sense of my head hair. And is that Mark? Is that me? No, I could shave my hair. Some of my hair is getting thinner and falling out. So that's not me. And then it's like body hair. And I think of like the hair on my arms or, you know, my legs or whatever. And then, you know, and you just keep going through teeth. Like, is teeth who I am? All right. Is teeth anxious, you know? And it's like, no, I could pull this tooth out and there's no loss of self, you know, like, and so it's a really interesting, kind of scary, to be honest, when you first start doing it, because you're just like, you're just these like tubes and organs, and you can't find a solid me anywhere. And it's both frightening and liberating, you know, and it really opens you up to a new dimension of possibility and wisdom. If you continue practicing and going into it over and over again, I think you can have deeper realizations of, you know, anatta, not, you know, not me, not mine, which ultimately frees you to choose how to respond. That I don't, even if my body's falling apart, I don't need to be miserable about it. I don't need to be an asshole to other people. It can just be, you know, painful body hurting, falling apart, you know, and it can be so direct and simple like that, you know?
Is it useful to perhaps think of it not in terms of, you know, again, if we're just told this idea of absolute spaciousness and then we're chasing it, and that's, we just talked about how that can be problematic, and you just walked us through some practical ways of getting there with dropping all of the labels and language. But I also wanted to ask if there are, you know, instead of, you know, finding the spaciousness, perhaps it's useful, you know, for me to look at what's getting in the way, you know, all of the ways, you know, I was reading Pema Chodron talk about this absolute bodhicitta, and she describes it a little bit differently from Jack Kornfeld. They both, I think, still call it an awakened heart, but she refers to it as being kind of like an open wound and a very tender place, and there might be some sadness there. So that, all of that aside, we, rather than just being with that place, there's just all of this stuff that's covering it up. We harden around it with separation, with anger, with jealousy, with our stories, all of these thought patterns. And so all of that stuff is a little bit of a contraction. And so for me, I also think it's useful to think of, you know, rather than trying to find this spaciousness, look at all of the things that is first covering up this spaciousness. And the more we can be with, you know, our anger, and the more we can, you know, maybe sit with, perhaps if I'm really angry at a friend, for example, who didn't text me back soon enough, and then I'm just sitting with that, and I'm sitting with that feeling. And then over time, the story maybe loosens a little bit. You know, I don't really feel as though his actions are causing me that much harm. It's just lost its charge as I've been able to maybe sit with it and give attention and give, you know, total awareness to it. And so that works with all kinds of different mental states,
right?
And all types of, you know, the ways that I'm clinging to an identity. I'm imagining myself in this scenario or that scenario. I am maybe worrying. I'm thinking about relationships, thinking about the future, all of that stuff. It has such momentum. And for me, it's about, you know, slowing that down and maybe stops in moments, stopping it, not necessarily stopping it, but just putting some space around it. And then from there, I can maybe begin to more and more uncover something that's a little bit bigger than all of that, you know, just this feeling of expansiveness, right? Does that make sense?
Right, right. And just, again, it you're observing those things. And in the observing, you're kind of resting in that thing at the same time, you know? So it's
you are, but it doesn't necessarily
feel that way.
It might not feel that way. It might just feel a little bit like just like observation. It doesn't feel necessarily spacious and open, and you don't really feel this big heart quality and connection to all beings. All of that stuff might not be there.
No.
We're just talking about this, I guess, clinical in the beginning, just this clinical observation. But I'm saying, which over time, the more we observe, the more it loosens. And I'm just speaking to this idea of uncovering this awakened heart rather than finding it.
Right,
it's
right.
A process of eliminating, well, what isn't this awakened heart? It's not this craving for Cheetos. It's not this, you know, being pissed off that I made this decision 5 years ago and dwelling on that. It's not whatever, being afraid of dying of COVID. And as we pull away all of these things that we use to harden and distract ourselves and to make ourselves feel secure, I think something can emerge from that.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I'm not even going to add anything to that. That's great. That's exactly it. And by the way, I tried to text you back as fast as I could. So these passive aggressive.
I texted you 5 minutes ago while you were talking, and you didn't get back to me. You should have stopped your rant to text me back during this podcast.
All right. See, we can talk about it. We're awakened. We have we got bodhicitta.
Amazing. So then, rather than perhaps harden around this suffering to deny it, just to maybe open up to it, you encourage people when you gave this talk to really breathe in the suffering. And the line that you said that really struck me deep is, we're trying to chip away at the fear of suffering. So to me, that means the more we hold just the simple experience of suffering, the more we can understand that it doesn't completely devour us.
Right.
You know, this feeling of, even if I'm afraid of getting a cold or I'm afraid that I'm going to get injured, you know, when I am truly suffering, the feeling is though I am being destroyed by these things. And the more we could sit with it, the more we could see that that's not happening. Is that
right? I mean, we're kind of hardwired to run away from suffering. I mean, anything that's uncomfortable, we don't want it. And we have this, like, Ezra Beta talks about this entitlement, and I really like this, that we have this entitlement that somehow life's supposed to make us happy, that it's supposed to feel good, that, you know, it's supposed to give us what we want. And, you know, I mean, I didn't come out of the womb with, you know, that warranty, you know? So it's just, to even look at that we're supposed to feel a certain way, that there's not supposed to be suffering. And I think I told you one of my favorite quotes is a mature practice is one that can sit with, the very things that you came to practice to get rid of. Right. And what we really want is a profound okayness, a deep sense of ease and contentment. And that doesn't come from our normal ways of doing things, like destroy the things we don't like and try to hold on to the things we do like. That's not real life, because discomfort is going to arise. I don't care what you do in your life, how you try to avoid it. Discomfort and suffering will happen in life. Aging is not pleasant. Sickness, not pleasant. Dying, probably not going to be too pleasant. Losing people we love, not pleasant. Coming in, you know, around people that we don't care for or that annoy us, it's unpleasant. Like, the nature of life is this dukkha, is this sense of dissatisfaction and difficulty. And it's not a problem to be solved. It's something to start embracing. It's like, I call it like just a mature, like it's like mature spirituality. Like, it's almost like, grow up. This is the nature of life. It's hard. And if you're having difficulty, of course, look at the situation. We're thrown into this body on a rock that's floating around a fireball in the middle of infinite nothingness. And we're, you know, depending on when let's talk about now, like, we have to earn money to make a living. We need health benefits, and it's not necessarily how we want it to be, you know, and people die randomly, and we will die and this experience will end. And holy shit, of course we're having a hard time. Like, look at the situation.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know where we came from. We don't know where we're going. And shit's hard all the time, or a lot of the time. And like, what the hell's going on? Like, how do we start to say, this is what it is, and this is how life is? And I think that's like the first noble truth of Buddhism. He's not just saying some metaphysical statement. He's saying, how can we start embracing this? Life is difficult. Life is unsatisfactory. Like, it's going to be hard. So how can we relate differently now? Like, how can we start practicing relating more skillfully with deeper wisdom, with more compassion? and, you know, head in that direction.
There's such an opportunity to connect with, you know, humanity at large when we really are able to be with our suffering in a way where we're not contracting or hardening around it, where we're really just feeling it fully.
And if you think about, you know, even the, like the worst things that human beings have done, why did they do those things? Because they couldn't stand how they felt, right? Why don't you like this? Think of a person you don't like. Why don't you like them? Because when you're around them, you don't feel good, right? And we have to kind of turn the camera around or turn the, you know, attention around and say, wait a second, it's not them. They might be bringing out this feeling of unpleasant, but it's my inability to be with this unpleasantness that is causing even more problems, right? This is my, this is my emotion. This is my reaction, and I'm responsible for it, you know? And again, it's not saying blame me, like in a guilt ridden, like, oh, I suck. It's my fault. But it's saying, okay, it might not be my fault that I feel this reaction, but it's my responsibility now to learn how to relate to this in a different way and to see things differently.
Wow. Yeah. That's so interesting. I mean, that's a perfect example of how we run away from our suffering. I guess, yeah, just being around. I mean, we all have people in our lives who, for whatever reason, we just don't want to be around them. We avoid them. Sometimes they absolutely should be avoided.
Right. Absolutely.
But, you know, just that sense of avoiding, you know, if we're thinking about somebody who's needy and we're pushing them away, sometimes it's related to a denial of this wound, because when we think of them, you know, we're reminded that we have those same qualities, and then we're maybe afraid of that. We're afraid of our own vulnerability. If someone's in pain, if someone's struggling, if someone's just maybe damaged and not likable. I think maybe it's ingrained in me through just growing up and being a kid in America and going to middle school and high school where people are pretty harsh. You know, we're gravitating towards attractive, charismatic people. We're maybe I'm pushing away people who are less flattering. And I think I do that because
it's conditioning.
Yeah. And I don't want to maybe come to terms with my own vulnerability there.
Right. You know? And even in the case of like a needy person, you know, maybe you grew up in a house, and I'm not saying you, but, you know, just an example, like where when you needed something, you were yelled at and you were made, you know, to feel shitty, like about your needs.
Yeah.
So you actually took that neediness and you pushed it out, like down into the shadow, right? So that's no longer, that can't be a part of me, because if it is, I will feel horrible and I won't be loved. So then when you see neediness in somebody else, you've already pushed it into the shadows, right? So when you see that quality in that other person, it's like a death for you, because, you know, being needy means death. You know, it's a survival thing, even though it's not like physical death, but being unloved or, you know, not being liked or made, you know, if somebody's making you feel like crap about your feelings, and, you know, so you adapt to that situation as a child and push certain aspects out. And, you know, it's funny because in relationships, you tend to find that the other person has the quality that you've pushed away in yourself. I don't know if you've noticed that in relationships, that their strength is your biggest fear.
You know, at the core of all of this feeling of that there's something wrong with what Pema Chodron describes as, you know, this tender open wound, you know, this core,
right.
Maybe
pain. Vulnerability, right.
And a lot of that's, obviously we have our own histories and experience and everyone's pain is different, but I think she's speaking maybe more to a larger tenderness that's just part of the human experience, just our basic vulnerability as being humans on this planet. And I think we're so interested in denying that feeling and maybe, avoiding someone who might be vulnerable or numbing ourselves out or maybe running to pleasure, that we're not just able to, you know, fully accept this feeling and this kind of tender place. And then ultimately this place is hugely pregnant with possibility for connection and ultimately our way into truly feeling happy and connected.
Right.
And is to connect with others on this feeling. It's like we're all these hardened shells bumping our shells up against each other because we feel like we have to, because we need these shells. But Then if we let these shells go, these, you know, we can truly merge and connect in our deepest, most vulnerable essences.
Yeah. And, you know, we're very good at distracting ourselves. I mean, that's what our culture is a one big distraction. I mean, look, we got phones that have instant access. We have television that we can get anything on. We can get anything anytime. You know, it's like, so we're so distracted and we don't even know how we feel at this point, you know, because it's just, I can constantly distract myself. I don't have to feel. And people are so afraid of sadness, of vulnerability, of grieving. And that's really a place of deep transformation. And I don't want to throw that word out again, but like that's where so many wholesome qualities are found. When I am really in touch with my sadness or grief, that's when I'm most loving. You know, like think of like 9/11, right? People who normally wouldn't even look at each other, who'd walk right past each other, bump into each other, they were willing to help each other because they were vulnerable. They were open. And that just goes to show you that our true nature is not evil like we were taught. Our true nature is good. It's covered up by habitual tendencies of self-preservation. You know what I'm saying? And that once something happens that's so just mind-blowing that the ego just falls apart. Right. And what's left is this care. Right. And then it fills up again. Like obviously after 9/11, it filled up and it's let's kill these people and let's blow these people up and let's, you know, but there was an initial openness. And I'm not saying we shouldn't take, you know, whatever. I'm not being like, let's love everybody. And that's not the real world. But, you know, there are skillful ways of dealing with things. And I think if we were all able to get in touch with our humanity rather than our beliefs, we would connect. I mean, if we walked into a room with 10 people and we all talked about our political views or our religious beliefs, we'd all be fighting, right? But if we walked into a room and said, I just lost my best friend and I am hurting deeply, everyone would understand that. Everyone would come together and say, wow, he's just like me. I lost my friend and it is really shitty, right? If we
And not just in a story way of like, oh, this is both part of our narratives, but just in that, oh, he's also felt that. Like it's almost like, he's also felt that deep ache.
Right.
Because these feelings run so deep. And when we can really be with these feelings and when it turns out other people had these feelings, I mean, that's as deep of a connection as what's possible between two people is that this feeling is shared and there's catharsis in that, as you described.
Just to finish up on that, it's our suffering that will bring us together, not our beliefs, not our, you know, judgments or it's that recognized shared suffering. And if we can't open to it, if we're not even willing to go there, we're never going to be able to connect with anybody, you know, and we're never going to have that deep connection that we're looking for. That's the thing that's so funny about it is we're looking for deep connection, but, you know, and that's a society nowadays. I remember telling somebody about writing a poem for someone and they're like, ugh, I don't want someone to write a poem for me. It's like, why? Like, you know, that's like somebody's feeling something for you. Like it's a real, like people don't want to feel anything anymore. It's just, let me distract myself. This is getting too real, right? That, oh, you wrote a poem for me. I'm out. This is too real. You know, I wanted to just, you know, post pictures of me and you on Instagram. I didn't want to actually feel something for you.
So one way to tap into this, I guess, feeling is Tonglen. And I'd love, you know, we're about at the end here. I'd love if you're up for it to just lead us in, you know, just a quick few minutes, maybe just introduce people to what Tonglen is.
Sure.
Yeah, I'd love to just practice for a couple minutes as a way to end.
All right, cool. Basically, Tonglen, sending and receiving. And it's really great when you're working with difficulties. You can do it with, you know, pleasant stuff too. But, you know, we don't really have problems with the pleasant stuff. We have problems with our difficulties. So basically, it's similar to where we started, where we're going to kind of touch into that. And basically, you're breathing in the suffering on the inhales, and you're willing to feel the ouch of it. And then you're breathing out relief. So you're kind of creating that equanimity between relief and suffering. You're learning to take both. You're learning to receive both. So just we'll do a very brief meditation here. So basically, you start off resting in that absolute, right? To bring that up again. You rest in just a very spacious awareness, just recognizing the moment as it is, receiving the moment, hearing sounds, noticing thoughts, feeling sensations. And that's where it starts. And then you get into the visualization. So you start imagining yourself breathing in this heavy, sticky, thick black smoke. And you're breathing that in through the nose, right to the center of the chest. And then it transforms into white, light, open, spaciousness, ease. And that's spread out in all directions on the exhale. Once you start to get into that breathing and that visualization, then you pick a particular situation that you're dealing with. And don't pick the most traumatic one that you can't handle. Like, pick something that's realistic, maybe some anxiety or something like that. And on the inhales, you're breathing in all the qualities of that anxiety. And you're trying to feel it. This isn't intellectual only. This is like breathing in the tightness in the chest, the rapid heart rate, the tension in the body. And then on that exhale, you feel that relief. You send out relief. So it might be ease or peace, joy, centeredness, steadiness, whatever. So you work with that for a few minutes. And then you open it up. And some people are frightened about this part, and you don't have to move to this step if you're not ready for it. But then you say, there's so many people that feel this. Let me breathe in their anxiety and all their suffering that comes with it so that they can be free from it. So you're breathing in all of this smoke from everybody, goes right to the chest where it's transformed, and then you send out that relief to yourself and to all other beings. And you do that for a few minutes, right? And that's chipping away at that fear of suffering. You're willing to take on other people's suffering. You're cultivating a mind that says, okay, I'm willing to suffer if I have to. If it presents itself in my life, I'm okay with that. I'll feel it. I'll use it. And then after a while, you just kind of come back to that spaciousness. You let the practice go. And I always like to take a breath or two to kind of come out. And then you just get back with your day. And what's great about this is that you can use it in such a practical way too, on the spot. So if you're feeling anxious on the train on your way to work, you can close your eyes and breathe in the anxiousness, send out relief. If you're sitting with a loved one in hospice, you can't really do much to help them, you know? So it's like, let me breathe in your fear. Let me breathe in your pain and all of this, you know, stuff you're going through, and let me send you ease and relief. So it's just such a wonderful practice. And you know, Pema Chodron is really big on teaching it. So if you really want to dive into it, you can look her up on YouTube or some of her books or talks. And
Thank you so much, Mark, for your meditations and for being here. This was great.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. That was Mark Van Buren, MVB. Thank you to Mark. His information is in the description. Please check him out. If you want to contact me, it's theanxietylab@gmail.com or SAGARBOT. As I mentioned, there will be a hiatus, and now is a good time if you want to get in touch and suggest topics that you want to hear discussed on future episodes. I always love hearing any thoughts you have on this episode or prior episodes, or just if you want to just send me what you're having for breakfast these days, no need to write it out in the body, put it right in that subject line. Anyway, thank you so much. It really means the world to me that you're here and you're listening. And until next time, be well.